Hello, everybody, and welcome to this month's CIO live stream. My name is Kiran Ganesh. I'm Global Head of Investment Communications here at the Chief Investment Office in UBS Wealth Management. It's been a really busy past week and past month since markets reopened after Christmas. We've seen President Trump return to the White House and tariffs are very high on the agenda. And we're also now seeing challenges for investors understanding the potential impact of DeepSeek, which is a new lower-cost AI model developed in China and unveiled last week. Of course, all factors like growth, inflation, and rates continue to be pretty important as well. To help you navigate what certainly does feel like a more complex investment landscape this year, I'm really excited to welcome my colleagues Ulrika Hoffmann-Bacardi, who's our Global Head of Equities here in the CIO, and Paul Donovan, our Global Chief Economist, I think two guests that can really help us understand some of these issues. We'll start with DeepSeek, because that seems to be the big topic of the week and where we've been getting the most questions. And we'll start with you, Ulrika, on this. Of course, a lot happening. Maybe you could just give us a quick recap of what's happened, what you think from here, and how you think investors should respond.
Yes. Hello, everyone, and thank you for having me. So let me start by saying that we see the fallout in the market from DeepSeek as a big opportunity in three ways. One, in investing in AI. Number two, investing in electrification and power and resources. And lastly, also the market itself. But let me start with what happened. So on January 20th, DeepSeek, which is a Chinese AI lab, launched its R1 model. This is a low-cost version of a prior model version of OpenAI's O1. And I have to say that this was not necessarily a surprise that DeepSeek is able to build more efficient and low-cost models. It has had a history of training models at much lower costs than what we have seen in the West. Part of this is, of course, due to the chip export restrictions that China is subject to. But this model made it very quickly to the top of the App Store, especially because of its low cost. It was by Thursday of last week, the number one app on various app stores. That led Marc Andreessen, a US venture capitalist, to call it the Sputnik moment for China AI. And the immediate market reaction was that anything compute related or also electricity, electrification, power related sold off quite heavily starting on Friday, but then particularly yesterday. We think this is a big opportunity. And first of all, let's maybe go through where we differ in terms of our assessment on what this means for AI compared to how the market first off, we believe in, it's an empirical law, the Jevons paradox, that when resources get significantly cheap, they get adopted disproportionately more. And the history of technology has shown this in many different ways, that this law holds in the semiconductor industry, Moore's law, the number and the price of transistors has inversely related if you look at that chart on the right. So our assessment is that this low-cost version of some of the Western models will be adopted more widely, and that ultimately the cost, the lower cost of AI, will lead to much more widespread adoption. Number two, we don't think that companies will spend less on training. CapEx plans, we've already heard from some of the hyperscalers. We'll hear more next week. They already announced their plans. And all these large cap internet names in the US are very well aware of these model developments. So this R1 moment didn't necessarily come as a surprise to the Metas and the Microsoft of this world. And yet they increased their CapEx spending over time. We believe that until we reach AGI, these frontier labs will continue to spend on GPUs to produce even better and better models with higher accuracy and reliability. So to sum it up, two things, wider adoption of AI and continued spend on training will only increase the demand for computational resources. And therefore, three opportunities that we see that investors can take advantage of. Number one, get invested into our trio, AI trio, our portfolio that we are managing around this theme across the different value chain layers of AI, the enabling layer, the intelligence layer, and the application layer. But also very often we see that the baby gets washed out with the bathwater, and that happened in power and resources. So many industrial and utility names dropped significantly yesterday. That in our view is also a misunderstanding because AI data center demand, even if we took this out, is only a very small portion of the power needs that we'll see over the next decade. In fact, we believe it's just about 10% of the incremental demand over the next 5 years. So again, an opportunity to get involved in our UBS CIO trio, power and resources. And lastly, the market also took a turn down. Lower cost of intelligence is good for one thing, for productivity, and higher productivity is good for the US equity market. So three opportunities that we encourage our clients and advisors to capitalize on in this environment.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ulrika. Very clear and taking a view against what the market was doing yesterday. I think that's really clear advice and guidance. But we'll, of course, come back later in the Q&A, and I'm sure we'll have some more follow-up. So thank you for that starter, Ulrika. Paul, we'll turn to you now. And in other news, there's a new US president, which has sort of flipped the market attention yesterday, at least. But of course, President Trump has been announcing a lot of different things since his inauguration, in particular focused around tariffs. So perhaps you can give us a bit of flavor on what you think is going to happen and what that might mean for US inflation and growth in particular, which is where we're getting the most questions. So, Paul.
Thanks, Kieran. Yes. So one of the issues, of course, is that US President Trump rather prides himself on the unpredictability of his style. It's a management technique. So we're getting lots and lots of back and forth. There was a speech at the World Economic Forum at Davos, which was very aggressive on tariffs and, you know, universal tariffs and so on. And then later on, the president dialed it back with regards to China and saying, look, I really don't want to tax Chinese imports into the United States. So you're backwards and forwards. And then over the weekend, in a dispute with Colombia, there was a threat of very aggressive tariffs and then a very, very rapid retreat from that position from the US president. So it's been a lot of back and forth. I think, however, it is pretty clear that President Trump believes tariffs are a good thing, all in capital letters, which is a bit of a difference from the first term, where I think tariffs were almost exclusively a bargaining tool. Now, some of the proposals are bargaining and some of them are a good thing which should be pursued in their own right. Now, there's two forms of tariff, essentially. The first is selective tariffs, and that's where you tax US consumers of imports from a single country. So tariffs on Chinese imports into the United States, for example. The thing about selective tariffs is that over time, you avoid those tariffs. They sort of decay in their effectiveness. And if you look at what happened in President Trump's first term, you know, as tariffs were imposed on consumers of Chinese imports, over time, China started rerouting its supply chain, and effectively about a third of China's exports to the United States now avoid those tariffs by going via Canada or Mexico or Vietnam or wherever. And so that removes some of the damage that the tariffs would do. Universal tariffs are a different thing. So a universal tariff is when US consumers of any import of a specific product are subject to tax. So in the first term, President Trump put in place a universal import on washing machines. And economists get really excited about washing machines. It's a fantastic case study. And what happened there, of course, is that you can't reroute. You know, there's no way of avoiding the tariff if all imports of that product are subject to a tax. So what is the impact? Well, when we look at the effect of tariffs on inflation, there's the first round effect, which the Federal Reserve, I think, will largely ignore. And then there's the risk of second round effects, which are a lot more serious. So the first round effect is that a tariff is just like any other sales tax in that consumers have a one-off increase in price as the tariff comes into play. So US consumers will experience a price increase. Now, very, very simplistically, the US imports about 12.7% of GDP. So a 10% tariff on all imports would raise US price levels by about 1.25%, 1.27%. Now, that's a very simplistic analysis, but that would be your direct impact, wouldn't cause the Fed to panic too much. The risk is the second round effects, and those are really come in two areas that I'm concerned about. The first of these is that if import tariffs work at all, then you get a reduction in the volume of imports going into the United States. But if that's the case, US companies then face less competition. And if they got less competition, that's an opportunity for them to raise prices. So not only do foreign goods prices go up, but domestic goods prices go up. That's exactly what we saw with washing machines. One of the reasons it's so exciting is that domestic manufacturers were raising prices very aggressively because they were being sort of protected by the tariffs from foreign competition. The second thing is the risk of a profit-led inflation episode. Now, a tariff is a sales tax that is applied to US consumers, but at the point of entry. It's not at the checkout in their store. It's when the goods arrive in the port of Los Angeles or the port of New York or wherever it is. And the thing is there that the import price, which is what you charge the tariff on, is only about 40% of the consumer price on average. So that means a 10% tariff should lead to a 4% increase in consumer prices. But because everyone hears 10%, 10%, 10% all the time, they sort of expect the 10% increase. And then that may give retailers an opportunity to sneak in some profit margin expansion under, you know, the story that, oh, it's all about the tariffs. And that would also then add to the inflation story. So I think we're going to get some inflation coming through, but I think there are disinflation forces in the US economy that will help offset that. So net net, inflation probably doesn't change that much. If we weren't seeing consumers being affected by tariffs this year, US inflation would be coming down. As it is, it's probably going to sort of stick around current levels with tariffs pushing up, other factors pushing down. It is a moderate negative for US growth because what you're doing here is undermining consumer spending power. But consumers have actually got quite a lot of spending power to start off with. So we're looking for a very modest decline in growth in the United States this year, but still a relatively good number overall.
Excellent. Thank you, Paul. And we'll come back to you later in the Q&A. So please keep those questions coming in for Paul as well. Ulrika, let's turn back to you again to get more into our investment views. I think you've given us already a good overview on AI and on DeepSeek, and I can see some questions coming in already on that. But we didn't get so much into the tariffs, and Paul has given us a bit of an overview of what it might mean for the economy. How are you thinking about it from an equity perspective, including on how it might shape some relative regional dynamics?
Yeah, we remain constructive on global equities, led by US equities in particular and the technology sector. We do think tariffs are an overhang. But I think we also, as Paul alluded to, have seen that Trump uses tariffs as a geopolitical negotiation tool. I think Colombia is a very good case in point, and I think he will do the same thing for all our trading partners in the world. So yes, we think there could be headline risk. We also see, you know, historically, in the face of initial escalation, the stock market has dropped as in response to that rhetoric. But we've even seen that drop has become smaller over time. So we think that there will be some tariffs. I think a lot depends on what the trading partners have to offer in return. And Trump's recent initial, you know, modest view on possibly what could happen with China, I think is a sign that he is willing to negotiate. So we think there is a possibility of rhetoric kicking up if trading partners don't respond with concessions. But we don't think in our base case that it's going to derail our 6,600 target in the S&P. We will, of course, remain vigilant in case there are very different types of proposals being floated. We do think that if tariffs were to become part of a broader legislative bill, that that would also be very difficult to do, to get more broader tariffs and a scenario with selective tariffs by product, by region is for us the most likely outcome.
Great. Thank you, Ulrika. You know, keeping the positive course despite the tariffs. There was one change in the equity view over the past month, which was an upgrade to U.S. healthcare. And before we get into the questions from our clients, perhaps we can just touch on that one. What was the thinking behind that upgrade to U.S. healthcare?
Yeah, that upgrade was largely valuation driven. We think we are at a point of peak uncertainty from a policy perspective. We have seen in prior periods, Hillary-Care, Obamacare, that valuations reach similar trough levels and just to rebound from those levels. The catalyst of why we think healthcare valuations could re-rate are the following. One, that we think Trump is not going to make it a policy priority. We have not seen evidence of that over the last weeks. It's also a sector that's very difficult to change if you look at past administrations. So I think he realizes that. And I think therefore the focus, you know, will turn away from the policy concerns and again back to the fundamentals of the sector. And there we think there is upside again structurally this year. Obesity, certainly advances also in surgical robotics that we think could lift the sector in different parts. And also some of the leading names in the sector, we believe, have upside to current earnings expectations. You know, apart from our exposure that we suggest in AI and also power and resources, it's a very good diversifier. We could see that yesterday where healthcare was, you know, one of the strongest positive sectors when technology, industrials, and utilities suffered. So we think there's upside, but we also think there is a diversification benefit from having healthcare in the portfolio.
Brilliant. Thank you, Ulrika. So let's get into the questions and please, you know, keep those coming in. I think just before we get on to that, I just wanted to highlight, I guess, a few of our other views. I mean, Ulrika's talked about our views on stocks, AI and power and resources very clearly. I think if you refer to our most recent house view, we also give some of our views on how to navigate some of the risks that are out there today, including hedging strategies. We talk about locking in yields and our view that we would expect to see bond yields moving lower. So a good opportunity to shift cash into medium duration fixed income, and also some opportunities in the currency space, which have been relatively volatile recently as they're digesting all this new information on tariffs in particular. So please refer to the latest house view for more information on those. But yeah, I was itching to get into the question, so why don't we do that right now? Please keep them coming in as well. So Ulrika, perhaps this first one to you. Do you think that DeepSeek will mean a reduction of the US's tech advantage? And will it mean the end of the dominance of the Magnificent Seven?
I don't think so. I think it's a good question. Certainly what we have seen, I think what DeepSeek shows is that if you have to operate under constraints, and for China, that means in particular GPU constraints that don't have access, you know, to the latest chip technology in China, you have to be creative. And what DeepSeek did, it innovated on top of existing open source models, and it innovated in quite interesting and profound ways. So I think that's something that, again, researchers across the world will learn from. But this is a very fast paced race, this AI race. And we have seen before, by the way, in China, this is not the first time China has come out with very efficient models. We have certainly seen the Yi model in 2023 that was only trained at a 3.3 million cost versus about 20 to 30x higher training costs in the US at the same time. And it is algorithmic innovations. These are not models. I just want to make sure, or at least R1 at this stage, that is at the very leading edge of AI models. So this model is on par with a former version of an OpenAI model. And it was very quickly on par with that model. I think that was the one fact that took people by surprise. But the US frontier models are still ahead if you look at the model rankings on Hugging Face. And I think we will also see new benchmarks developed over time because currently a lot of these new models, there are hitting a lot of the accuracy and reliability benchmarks, the reasoning benchmarks, but we will come up with more and more difficult benchmarks where we can compare these models. And it's a race, it's a worldwide race, but I think everybody is going to profit from algorithmic innovation, on top of these large frontier models. Again, lower cost of AI is a good thing. That lower cost of intelligence, it gets deployed more broadly and ultimately benefits companies who are applying AI in the different parts of the value chain.
Brilliant. Thank you, Ulrika. I've got some questions coming in around some of Trump's sort of other policies beyond tariffs. So, Paul, perhaps give you a few minutes to just reflect on the withdrawal of the US from the OECD's minimum corporate tax rate introduced, I think, last year, and also even today announcing pausing federal loans and grants. So yeah, I guess any reflections on those, or other policies that we haven't talked about that you think would be worth highlighting and that you've got on your radar?
Well, we're rather spoilt for choice. There's been a real flurry of executive orders. Of course, not all of these actually take effect immediately. I mean, there's processes and procedures and so on. So not all of this is an immediate effect. On the global corporate tax rate thing, I think the issue here is that it really signals the US, at least for the next few years, is unlikely to be cooperating with international organizations and so on and so forth. Does it end the global minimum corporate tax? No, it doesn't. I mean, the global minimum corporate tax rate was rather designed for this eventuality. There was a clear way of making sure that it was in countries' interest to be part of this. Now, President Trump has said he's going to retaliate against other countries. The reality is that that would be a very, very difficult option to do if Europe, for example, insists on minimum corporate tax on US companies and Trump wants to retaliate, there would be very negative repercussions, and I don't think that's going to pan out. We also need to remember that the minimum corporate tax rate is, certainly for Europe and quite a lot of emerging markets, is a populist measure. This is something which has very widespread support. It came out in many ways from sort of a social media-led single issue politics movement. So I don't think we get retreating from that from the rest of the world. As far as the grants disbursements, and we've also had disruption to universities and to public health institutions. Here, I think there is obviously a short-lived negative implication. Now, it's very, very clear that there will be a legal and constitutional challenge over the quote, temporary freezing of grants and loans, because there are a whole series of arguments against that. So it may well be that in a month or two, this reverses. But for the time being, that is a short-term negative, that you're not injecting this cash into the economy. The issue for me is what happens in the longer term. Because what we've got to remember, we hear the words grants and loans, and we think of these things as sort of abstract concepts. But actually, at the end of the day, these are paying people's salaries. And if people now have more insecurity in where their salary is coming from, they may then be tempted to engage in what economists call precautionary savings, so savings for a rainy day. And that would start to shift the savings consumption balance. Now, I do not believe we are at that tipping point, but that is something to look for if this drags on as a process and it's not just a short-lived gesture and then we move on from it. And on some of the other issues in terms of research funding in the longer term, one of the things to remember is if you break up a research lab, it doesn't come back together again very easily. You break up a research lab, the researchers disappear off to Canada or Oxford or Cambridge if they're unlucky. They scatter around the world, and then you don't get them back so quickly. Now, again, we're nowhere near that tipping point now, but that's a thing to look at if this drags on. My suspicion is that this is going to be a short-lived gesture, and it's not necessarily going to be a long-term problem.
Brilliant. Thank you, Paul. And yes, keep these questions coming in. We've talked a lot about the US and, I guess, innovations in China for obvious reasons. I guess Europe getting left out a little bit from our live stream so far. So we've got a question coming in there. Any view on European equities, and would a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia change the picture? Ulrika, I'll leave that one to you.
Great question. And one thing that we pointed out in our 2025 surprises that we see upside for Europe in particular, driven by Germany. We have elections coming up in Germany. We see that there's a chance that a government under Merz would follow more pro-growth policies. I mean, obviously, he's already been in discussions with Trump on contributions for NATO, which would increase defense spend. And I do think that could be somewhat of a sea change in terms of European equity markets. One way that we have been recommended to take advantage of that is through structured products. But we do believe that valuations right now in Europe are so low that any slight fundamental change, for example, on the fiscal policy side, would be enough to re-rate the market. Structurally, we still think Europe is not in the same position as other parts of the world, not participating to the same extent in the largest innovations on the AI side, but also have some exposure to power and resources, in particular on the grid infrastructure side, but also on electrification. So again, we have definitely pointed out the opportunity at this stage through structured products, but I think the combination of potentially a ceasefire in Ukraine, which I think is more likely than not, and pro-growth policy makes us at least a little bit more bullish on potential upside.
Brilliant. Thank you, Ulrika. And I think we've just got a few more seconds, so perhaps I'll just sum up now. Thank you for sending in all of the different questions. So I think we've had a clear view on artificial intelligence and what to make of it in light of the sell-off and the opportunities in the AI trio and in the power and resources trio laid out by Ulrika. Paul's given us great guidance on what to not to worry about on tariffs and what to worry about on tariffs amid a lot of announcements from President Trump. I think great questions coming in from all of you, and I think a clear view as well on emergent opportunities coming in European equities. So thank you all for joining. Please join another live stream soon for your questions. This is a very interesting market, and I'm sure we'll have lots to discuss in the weeks and months ahead. So stay tuned, and thank you for joining.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.